This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 2nd of October. A plane carrying British nationals escaping from the war in Lebanon has landed in Birmingham this evening. We'll hear from one of them. It comes as 8 Israeli soldiers have been killed in fighting with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. We'll get the latest on the developing war in the Middle East and on Israel's likely response to yesterday's attack by Iran. President Biden says America won't support attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. But will the Israelis listen to him? Also, have any of the Tory leadership candidates had a game-changing Cameron moment with their party conference speeches? The unlikely solution to a moth mystery and the dad who walked for hours through America's hurricane-ravaged landscape to be at his daughter's wedding. Earlier this evening, a charter flight from Beirut landed at Birmingham Airport on board British nationals escaping from the escalating situation in the Middle East. In the past hour, more signs of Israel's intent. Reports that the son-in-law of Hezbollah's late leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was among those killed in an Israeli airstrike on a building in the Syrian capital, Damascus. And there have been reports as well of more Israeli airstrikes in the south of Beirut. It comes as the IDF has confirmed that 8 Israeli soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon in the ground offensive there against Hezbollah. The sound there of other injured soldiers being airlifted from Kfar Giladi in northern Israel. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has expressed his condolences in a statement.
I would like to send my condolences from the bottom of my heart to the families of our heroes who fell today in Lebanon. God will save their blood. May their memory be blessed. We are in the middle of a tough war against the evil axis of Iran, which seeks to wipe us out. This will not happen because we will stand together, and with God's help, we will win together. We will return our hostages in the south. We will return our residents in the north. We will guarantee the eternity of Israel.
All this, of course, a day after those Iranian ballistic missile strikes on Israel. The BBC's Lucy Williamson is in the north of Israel. So what have people there been telling her after those missile strikes?
People up here are very used to having rockets come over the border every day, but this was seen as something different, something affecting the whole of the country where the stakes were higher, the scope was wider. But there's also, talking to people today just outside Tel Aviv, one of the sites where the Iranian missiles hit, where it actually landed, there's a growing sense of kind of weariness with the whole escalation, the whole situation that Israel's been living through for the last year or so. I spoke to the mayor of Hod HaSharon near Tel Aviv. And he said, look, people here have been living in such a surreal reality for the past year that it feels like every day brings something new that makes yesterday look sort of blasé, sort of normal. And people are just living that day to day. So they're reacting to it differently. In terms of what the government is saying today, I mean, you heard the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night saying Iran has made a big mistake and will pay for it. He's been talking very tough, as you'd expect. His US ally, as you'd expect, still keen to avoid being dragged into a full-blown regional war. But Mr. Netanyahu hasn't been listening very closely to Washington recently. And when you speak to people here, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who are echoing the calls of politicians and commentators urging him to really hit back hard and hit Iran in its strategic sites.
BBC's Lucy Williamson. So what might Israel do now as it weighs how to retaliate to those Iranian missile strikes? Well, it could go down a conventional military route, perhaps attacking the bases from which those missiles were launched. Another possibility, the economic route. That could include Iran's most vulnerable state assets, such as its petrochemical plants. And then, of course, there is the big one, the nuclear option. What could they do if they targeted Iran's nuclear facilities? Well, President Biden made it clear today that he and the other leaders of the G7 countries do not support that option.
The answer is no. I think we'll be discussing with the Israelis what they're going to do. But they have, all seven of us agree that they have a right to respond, but they should respond in proportion.
Well, David Albright is the founder of the Institute for Science and International Security. He's an American weapons expert, and he's written several books about nuclear proliferation. He helped to inspect Iraq's nuclear program in the 1990s. And he told me about the current state of Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Iran is very close to being able to make weapon-grade uranium. Essentially, if they really put their mind to it, within days, they could have enough weapon-grade uranium for a nuclear weapon. Within a month, enough for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 nuclear weapons. So it's quite a capability to produce the raw nuclear explosive material for a nuclear weapon. Less is known about their ability to turn that into a nuclear weapon. I mean, our own assessments are that in 6 months, they could make a crude nuclear explosive, not deliverable by a missile by any means, but you know, they would have a bomb. They could test it underground. They could proclaim they have nuclear weapons.
So if the Israelis do decide that this is the moment to target Iran's nuclear capabilities, what are their options?
It's certainly within Israel's capabilities. I mean, they would have to destroy some enrichment plants. One is very deeply buried. We'll, you know, debate whether they could really destroy it, but probably if they were going to attack, they would feel they could. They'd be trying to destroy centrifuges wherever they are in the enrichment plants and storage facilities. I'm sure they would be targeting the stocks of what we call 20% and 60% enriched uranium. Those are the stocks that really give Iran this ability to make weapon-grade uranium quickly. If Israel is going to actually strike, they're going to have to evaluate the probability of doing serious damage to where they really can extend the time that Iran needs to produce enough weapon-grade uranium for a bomb. And I would say the more we talk about it, the more time between and the longer it takes Iran to Israel to attack, the more chance Iran has to hide these materials, centrifuges, stocks of enriched uranium.
And can Israel do this alone? Because we have heard from President Biden today, he does not support Israel attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. So can they do it without American help, without America being on board?
I'm sure they could probably do quite a bit of damage to the Iran's nuclear facilities that we're talking about without U.S. help. Where they would need U.S. help is in countering Iranian retaliation, rearming. And so I think Israel, if they decide to do it, they can do tremendous damage to Iran's sensitive nuclear capabilities, nuclear weapons capabilities. From another point of view, Iran is being kind of pushed into a corner. I mean, it's one of its major deterrents against Israeli and U.S. strikes was Hezbollah and Hamas, that the so-called ring of fire that Iran created with its proxies that could keep Israel from striking Iran. Well, that hasn't worked very well, or, you know, been horribly damaged. Iran also said, well, we can deter Israel because we can really smash him with our missiles. Well, that's failed twice now. So Iran is probably thinking about what kind of deterrent will really work. And so I would say the chance that Iran is going to build nuclear weapons has increased as a result of recent activities. Israel perceives that very sensitively, if I can be diplomatic, and it may feel, well, now is the time to strike because Iran could be making a decision to build weapons and they're very vulnerable. They can launch their missiles, but we can shoot them down and we will get help with the United States to do that. So I think we're in a very dangerous point where Iran's incentive to build nuclear weapons has gone up. Iran's vulnerability to being attacked is at an all-time high, and Israel may take that opportunity to attack, regardless of what the United States wants. And Israel will be trying to buy time, you know, and hope that the future leads to a better outcome.
That was the American weapons expert, David Albright. Just an update coming from the Lebanese Health Ministry. They put out a statement saying in the past 24 hours, 46 people have been killed, 85 wounded in Israeli airstrikes. Well, let's look now in more detail at what the options open to Israel are. We're joined by Professor Chuck Freilich. He was Israel's Deputy National Security Advisor for 5 years. He's now Senior Fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. He joins us from New York. Welcome to the programme, Professor Freilich.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
If you were in your old role as National Security Advisor, what would you be advising the Israeli government to do in response to the Iranian missile attack?
Well, it starts with the fact that I think there does have to be a significant response, because this is the second time in 6 months that Iran has fired a massive barrage of missiles and, in the previous case, other capabilities at Israel. And that's not something that we can allow to become normalized and for Iran to think that they can do it freely. So first of all, it's got to be significant. In the first case, and back in April, Israel's response was very, very limited. It was just a one-off pinpointed attack, and it does not seem to have driven the point home to Iran. Then there's,
You know, I was just going to ask whether the window of opportunity that we heard David Albright talk about is there. Is that something you think is shared by the Israeli leadership at the moment in terms of targeting Iran's nuclear facilities?
Well, I mean, we're talking at a good time, because after what was really maybe certainly one of the worst years in Israel's history, in the last few weeks, the situation has changed, and we have Iran and the so-called axis of resistance on the defensive, and Hezbollah has been taken down dramatically, and I think far more easily and quickly than was expected. And Hezbollah was Iran's primary capability for hitting back against Israel in general, and specifically if Israel or the U.S. or anyone ever decided to attack their nuclear program. And Hamas has been defeated militarily, not politically, but militarily. And the other Shiite militias have all gotten involved, but not too much. So now Iran is also very vulnerable. It's clearly penetrated very, very effectively by Israeli and other intelligence agencies. It is an opportunity. And as Albright was saying, I mean, they are so close to being able to break out. He's saying 6 months to a crude capability, and maybe it's another half year, year to an actual missile. Yes, this is maybe the last window of opportunity to attack the nuclear program. And if the decision isn't to do that, there are other ways of...
We'll get onto those. But do you think Israel will try to hit those nuclear targets?
Well, I don't know. And if I did, I wouldn't say. But like I'm saying, this what I will say is that this is certainly a unique opportunity to do so.
Does it matter that President Biden is saying we don't want it to happen?
Of course it matters a great deal. I mean, if you personally, my opinion, there are only two critical questions that have to be addressed here. One is the operational capability. Does Israel have the ability to do something effective? Of course you can launch a strike and it'll destroy something. The question is whether you really gain time of significance. And the other, I believe, is primarily the American response and other states, prominently British. But first of all, the American response.
You were about to talk about other non-nuclear options, perhaps economic ones. What would you single out as possibilities?
Well, the one that's most dramatic, or there are two most dramatic ones. One is if Israel was to hit their oil exporting capabilities. Oil is most of the Iranian economy, and it is a huge infrastructure throughout the country. It is extremely vulnerable. And most prominently there, you have the Kharj Island export facility. The other thing that you could do would be to hit regime targets. Not that these strikes would in themselves topple the regime, but they would create a threat. And the one thing that the Iranian regime really fears is its future.
On the oil issue, would they be able to do that without causing a significant worry in terms of the international price of oil, though, for other allied countries more broadly?
Sure. I wasn't saying destroy their entire oil exporting capability, but if you hit one or two sites that don't affect the international price but send a very clear message to Iran what could be done in the future, and you can put together any variety of target sets that you want. You can hit, I'm just making this up, hit one oil facility and one regime target and something else.
So a range of possibilities, in short. Professor Freilich, former Deputy National Security Advisor of Israel, thanks very much for joining us. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headline so far on The World Tonight: the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said his country will stand together after 8 of its soldiers died fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon. Sir Keir Starmer has paid back more than £6,000 worth of gifts after criticism from opposition parties. And scientists say their work to map the brain of a fruit fly will lead to an avalanche of information about the human mind. Now, can one speech at a party conference really make a difference in the battle for political leadership? Well, when it comes to the Conservative Party, political folklore says it can. Exhibit A, David Cameron's speech without notes to the Tory faithful in 2005. It was seen as a game-changing moment, a moment that tilted the contest away from the pre-conference favourite David Davis and towards the future Prime Minister. And that familiar word, change, was at the heart of the Cameron message 19 years ago.
We can change this party and we can change this country, but we need the courage to do it. It will be a wonderful journey. There will be no turning back, no false starts, no more tacking one way then tacking another. We will stick to it. And let the message go out from this conference that a modern, compassionate conservatism is right for our times, right for this new generation, right for our party and right for our country. And if we have the courage to grab it, to seize it, the bravery to fight for it with every ounce of vigour and passion in our bodies, nothing and no one will stop us.
Well, today in Birmingham, the four current contenders to be the next leader of the opposition had their chance to create a Cameron moment with their conference speeches. Here's a flavour of them.
These institutions are creating an arsenal of laws by which illegal entrants frustrate their removal. You can't reform the European Court. It's a fantasy. The choice before us is leave or remain. I'm for leave.
If you went to reform, I want to show you the conservative values that we share. If you went to the Lib Dems, I want you to see the opportunities that only we can deliver. And if you went to Labour, I want to show you why freedom is how we build.
For too long, government stayed silent as women were sacked for saying that a man cannot be a woman. I fought for them while Labour called them bigots.
He cut taxes. He cut regulation. He boosted military spending and he won a landslide. So let's be more like Reagan. Let's be enthusiastic, relatable. Let's be more normal.
Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat, Kemi Badenoch, and at the end there, James, cleverly hailing not Margaret Thatcher, but her political soulmate across the Atlantic. Well, joining us now, two former Conservative MPs who followed today's speeches by those four leadership hopefuls. Tom Hunt, former Conservative MP for Ipswich. He lost his seat in July's general election. Good evening.
Good evening.
And Margot James, she was Conservative MP for Stourbridge between 2010 and 2019. She quit her role as Minister of State for Digital and Creative Industries to vote to block a no-deal Brexit. Good evening, Margot.
Good evening, James.
Tom, first of all, you were there, weren't you, watching those four make their pitch. What kind of impressions did they make on you?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. I think that the speeches were important, but you know, we had 3 days at the conference fair, and it wasn't just the speeches. We had the Q&A sessions on the Monday and Tuesday. I thought they were all good in their own ways. You know, as a Conservative, I think each one of the four would be far better than the Labour Prime Minister we've got at the moment. You'd expect me to say that.
I would, yeah.
But of course, you know, I am supporting Robert Jenrick, so, you know, you probably wouldn't also be surprised to know that I think that was the best speech of the four. But I think you know, James Cleverly did well. I think Kemi did well.
James Cleverly got the longest standing ovation, didn't he? I think 1 minute and 10 seconds.
But it went down well. I think that there's a point to be made there about whether the members at the conference in the conference hall are necessarily representative of the members across the whole country. So I don't necessarily think that's the most scientific way of judging which one will go down the best when it comes to a vote in a final two, if he gets to a final two. But no, I mean, James is a nice bloke. He's clearly got charisma. And I understand why some people are supporting him.
Well, Margot, what did you make of the speeches?
Well, I think the intro, the comparison with the Cameron speech of nearly 20 years ago, one key difference is, of course, that the field is only narrowed down to four. So the consensus seems to be that James Cleverly left the conference most delighted, I suppose, the members there present. But of the four, I'm still behind Tom Tugendhat. I think he's values-driven, he's serious, he's purposeful. He's got a very impressive track record. And I wonder really whether the speeches will change that many people's intentions, because, of course, it's all back to the MPs next week now. To get down to the final two.
Yes, well, it's interesting.
So many MPs are already made up
their mind, and two former MPs clearly have already made up their mind and haven't been swayed by the speeches either. But I suppose that is a big question, isn't it? When it comes to whoever it is who gets into the final two, will those performances have made a difference to the members who get the ultimate choice?
Indeed, and that could well be the case. That could well be the case. I think that the surprise is that Robert Jenrick, having gone into the conference in the lead, having been buoyed up by his main rival, Kemi Badenoch's various gaffes through the conference, then seemed to run out of steam during the speech. I heard some highlights of it. I think it's always best if you're going to make jokes, they've got to be funny. Otherwise, you're best being serious. And I thought his jokes were pretty lame.
He did it without notes, though. He's the only one.
Well, that's all very well, but that's not an end in itself, is it? You want a good speech. If you have to refer to a few notes, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Yes, Cameron really made the grade with his no-note speech, but it was his message that really was most impressive. He managed to persuade the Conservative Party of a few home truths that they had to change, that they should give up waiting for the electorate to change. They needed to change. And I don't think any, really, of the four candidates really made that case bravely enough that I would have wanted to have seen.
Well, Tom...
I mean, Jenrick was really the worst in that regard, because his stall is really doubling down on the promises Conservatives made in government, which turned out to be undeliverable.
Right, well, Tom, I suspect you want to come in support of your candidate. First of all, what about the jokes? I mean, are they important? Did you think he was funny?
I mean, things like that can obviously be quite subjective. I mean, I found the jokes I heard from Rob funny. But anyway, the key thing here, though, is the substance of what they're proposing. Ultimately, the Rwanda bill wasn't delivered because the Prime Minister at the time wasn't prepared to take the steps necessary to deliver it.
But would you accept what Margot's saying about Robert Jenrick doubling down rather than doing something different?
Well, I mean, I knocked on thousands of doors at the election in my constituency. Immigration was a major concern for many people in the town. It was a major reason why so many voters in my constituency abandoned the Conservative Party, because, you know, we weren't delivering on immigration. And ultimately, that's why Robert Jenrick resigned from government, because he could, the Prime Minister wasn't prepared to take the steps that he thought were necessary to get on top of our borders. So, you know, I think immigration is a key issue. I think anyone who pretends that it isn't, I think, is in cloud cuckoo land. The idea that I completely object to this, you know, Robert was running out of steam in his speech. I thought it was a very energetic speech. I'm not going to respond to, you know, be critical of Tom's speech, because I don't really think that's particularly helpful. But I thought it was a very strong performance from Rob. It was passionate, and I think he wants to take us in the right direction. But ultimately, A speech is a speech. You know, the key thing at the moment is we have the right policy platform going forward. And I think Rob, in my view, offers that.
Right. Well, thank you both for your impressions of the speeches today. Tom Hunt, former Conservative MP, and Margot James, also former Conservative MP. Thank you both very much.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, when the ecologist Daisy Cadet spotted a couple of moths at her home in Wales, she became rather fascinated by their translucent wings. But she couldn't have anticipated that when she posted a few photos of her house guests on social media, that would start a hunt for the origin of what was a previously unknown species, a journey which began 4,500 miles from her home and ended at the Natural History Museum. And she has been telling her story to The World Tonight's Sean Lay.
This was back in February when I noticed on the windowsill this quite distinctive moth. It looks like a little wasp, but it has clear wings. Next to it was a dead one. I kind of know a little bit about UK moths and things, and I'm no expert at all, but I knew that it was a clear wing, so it was kind of uncommon and a bit special. I got quite excited about it. I took lots of pictures of it, and I put it on Instagram, and that was when one of my followers, Graham Davis, who knows quite a lot about moths in the UK, noticed that this was something not as normal as I thought it would be.
So what did you do at this point when Graham... All of this happened quite quickly, I guess, once you'd put it out there on social media.
I think Graham messaged me within an hour or two of this happening. I had put the moths in a container because I was so excited to find this, thinking it was a UK species anyway. My plan was to just take some pictures of them, but Graham had been in contact with a couple of his contacts who knew a lot more about moths and butterflies in the UK, one of them being the contact at the Natural History Museum. And I ended up getting on the train and taking these two moths down to London and meeting the scientists so that they could have a really good close look.
How excited were they?
They were very, very excited. Within the day, they had kind of narrowed it down to a group of moths that you find in the Mediterranean region. So there was the possibility that it had come over on some houseplants, or I had been to Spain last year, so it could have been that. But there was no exact match. So after that, there was no confirmed species. So then the next step would be to get the DNA analysed. I think it was genome sequencing or something like that. And then the email comes through that there's a match to, it was about 80%, 90% match to a South American genus of moth, at which point when we're reading this, it's like, oh, okay, connecting the dots a little bit here. I think we know. My mum had been to South America, to Guyana. She was on a trip through the region, so rainforest and savannas, the Amazon River and all of these. So once we had this information that it must have come from South America, we were thinking, okay, right. I asked my mum, have you picked up anything? You know, a couple of leaves, but nothing that two moths are going to come out of. And so at this point, we began the search through all of her bags. So and she went over as a photographer, so she had a lot of kits in pockets, and all of this kit was in the same room that the moths were found. So as we're going through everything, we get to the boot bag, and this was kind of like the eureka moment. And okay, it's quite muddy, there's a lot of debris in here, and then I find a chunk of wood. It was like a piece of wood, and this piece of wood had two little holes. Which is like, right. It was just absolutely insane. And the chances of all of these things happening, the odds that somebody would see the story of the moth on my Instagram, and then the links, and then just everything.
Daisy Cadet, who accidentally discovered a new moth species, but deliberately spoke to The World Tonight's Sean Lay. Now, in the United States, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been travelling to some of the southeastern states which have borne the brunt of Hurricane Helene. More than 150 people have died in a storm that has swept away homes and caused some of the worst destruction and flooding seen in that part of America in generations. But in the middle of the destruction, there are also some heartwarming tales, including one of a man who was so determined to reach his daughter's wedding in Tennessee at the weekend that he walked around 17 miles on foot. David Jones had already driven 7 hours when a state trooper told him that the road ahead was blocked and that he could go no further. And David told me what happened next.
It was 2 a.m. It had been a 7-hour drive up until that point. Normally would have been 1.5 hours. So I was a little tired, a little frustrated at the length of the ride, and now they're telling us we can't go any further. I speak to the state troopers, and they're saying, no, the interstate is out, the back roads are washed out, and we really don't even know the full extent of the damage there, and we're not letting anybody drive on any of the roads. And I said, well, how about on foot? No, sir, we can't allow you to go out there. We just don't know yet. Too early to assess and too dark. So the troopers went about their way. They headed off wherever they were going to go do their trooper thing. And
and you're going to do your dad thing.
I'm going to do my dad thing. I told the trooper, I said, look, sir, with all due respect, my daughter's getting married at 11 o'clock in Johnson City, and I'm going to be there to walk her down the aisle. And he said, I appreciate your position, but can't let you go. So they turned around, went and did their thing. I grabbed my backpack, got my shaving kit, a couple of changes of underwear and socks, and my cell phone with the cell phone light, and I started down the back roads, the old highway. And I just kept putting one foot in front of the other with that soundtrack playing in my head. My daughter's getting married at 11 o'clock, and I'm going to be there to walk her down the aisle.
And what did you encounter along the way? Because there must have been a lot of damage done by the hurricane.
The destruction was beyond my ability to describe it. Piles of twisted trees and parts of fences and farm equipment and people's belongings from their homes. Some of it was just ankle deep, and with the light, I could dodge it and walk around it. Some of it was 6 and 7 feet tall, completely blocking the road. At one point, I encountered a bulldozer and a backhoe, and they were zooming across the road, back and forth, trying to push the debris off to one side or the other. There's the backhoe was spinning around, doing its thing, scooping stuff up and dropping it off. And I had to get through there.
And how visible were you? What were you wearing? Could they see you?
They didn't see me. This was the problem. I'm waving my cell phone light at the bulldozer driver, trying to get his attention. And when he finally noticed, he was startled. And he was like, where did you come from? And so he rolled his window down and I said, excuse me, sir, can I get through here? He said, I don't think so. The road is completely blocked. I don't think you can get anywhere. I said, well, I need to try. My daughter's getting married at 11 and I want to be there to walk her down the aisle. And he said, well, I'll radio the other guy and ask him to stop for a minute. I stepped down in some mud. It was like quicksand. I just went right down to my knees, and it caused me to fall back in a seated position, and I was stuck. I couldn't move, and the backhoe had started back up again, and he's swinging his boom around, and every time I heard it swing, I'd kind of flinch and look over, and I'm thinking, sooner or later, he's going to finish that pile that he's on, and he's going to come over and start on this pile. And he can't see me.
This could all have ended up in a very, very different way.
Yes, it could.
So look, you managed to get through this mud and twisted trees, and you get to the interstate eventually, don't you? How far did you walk in total? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, since I'm a marathoner, I wear a running watch. I started it. It ended up being 17 miles of walking and 10 miles of hitchhiked rides. I was able to get a ride finally at the end all the way in to my home. I get there at 7:30 in the morning. There's no power there, but I was able to wash up, drag out an old suit and some old shoes and get to the church on time.
I did wonder when you talked about falling back in the mud what sort of state you were in to walk your daughter up the aisle, but you'd managed to get change.
No, I was covered in mud, actually.
So what did she say? She must have been very worried. Presumably communications were very bad at the time. She wouldn't have even known whether you were going to make it or not.
She just knows her dad. She knew I was going to be there. She didn't know anything about any of this because none of us had cell phone service. And I told some of the family, but I instructed them to not tell Elizabeth before the wedding. Don't upset her on her special day. We had the candlelight service because there was no power at the church. And we ended up at the reception at a restaurant that did have power.
So it was a candlelit wedding?
Yes, it was. In fact, the priest made a joke about it to Daniel, her husband. He said to Daniel, I know you love Elizabeth. I know you're a man of influence, but you have really gone to great lengths to make sure she had a candlelight ceremony.
And her father went to great lengths to get there. So when your daughter did find out, when you told her or someone told her what had happened, what journey you had had to undertake to make it, what was her reaction?
I picked up a reflector along the way to warn traffic as I was walking because it was a narrow road with no shoulder. And I brought that to the reception and I told the story. And as I was telling, I presented this reflector to Daniel and Elizabeth and I asked them to, anytime they saw it, to remember to always be a protector for each other, especially in your darkest hours, just as this was for me. So that brought it full circle for everybody. A lot of tears, a lot of hugging, and then just pure joy.
Well, I have to say, as the father of a daughter, you have raised the bar for all of us in terms of commitment. Oh,
Jamie, I know you would have done the same for your daughter if you were in my position.
David Jones there, who got to the church on time. Now let's go back to that story about the chartered flight, which arrived in Birmingham tonight, carrying British nationals out of Lebanon. Hanan Baba, who is a life coach from London and describes herself as half British, half Lebanese, was on it. She had travelled to Lebanon to visit her father at the beginning of September. She was staying in the country's second largest city, Tripoli, and she recorded this for The World Tonight after landing back in the UK.
It's been a very long, exhausting day. At 10:30 this morning, I got an email telling me that I was given a place on the flight. So I had about 30 minutes to pack and leave the house because my family in Lebanon lives a few hours away from the airport. So it was very rushed and didn't really have a lot of time to say goodbye to my family as I would have liked. So that was quite upsetting and just saying bye to them, not knowing when I'm going to see them again. So my dad is based out there and just not knowing what's to come was just very scary and quite distressing. And then took a taxi to the airport and that was quite scary because there's been a lot of bombs that are like nearby the airport. So I was just trying to stay calm as much as possible. It was not the best of journeys, to be honest. It was very hectic. Eventually managed to get checked in. Yeah, so it was a very long journey. We ended up leaving 2 hours after we were supposed to. I spoke to a bunch of people on that flight. It was a lot of tears. The girl next to me was crying and I was speaking to her and she was telling me how she's not concerned about her safety as much as how much she worries that she's left her mother and her siblings behind. And so as we were taking off, a lot of people were, you know, looking out the window and just really sad to see us leave, I think. I think for me, I was reflecting on it and I kind of like see it as if like your younger sibling was drowning, but you can't swim yourself to save them. You know, I think like that's how it feels.
Hanan Baba there now back in London. And the government has said that a second flight from Beirut will take off tomorrow if it is safe to do so. And just before we go, news coming in from the Lebanese capital tonight from the BBC's Anna Foster, who is there. She's reporting what appears to be another massive blast, but this time in the centre of the city. She says that we heard a loud explosion. I span around to see the orange flash and flames reflected in the windows of the buildings around a mile away. This is an airstrike not far from downtown in central Beirut. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami from all of us here. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.